Hey, I'd like to welcome everybody to a very special Glasses Falling. All right.
These are the outtakes.
This is how I start my podcast typically, and I just let these bloopers go until we finally start. So yeah, this is the podcast. This is how we roll. So this one just might make it. So we're doing another special podcast. This one's going to be about the critical theory of religion, or not quite just about the critical theory of religion, but about Rudolf J. Siebert. It'll be an autobiographical podcast about his life, which is truly amazing. And if anybody's seen Forrest Gump, this guy has done way more than he ever did. So with that being said, I've got Rudy in the studio with me, and I've got my brother, Dustin John Bird, with me too. We call him DJB for short because he's just that cool. But Dustin, he is a scholar, so he's not used to those cool names and initials. So without any ado, Dustin, it's good to have you here. It's your show. Take it.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. And, I'm here with my mentor, my doctor father, Rudolf J. Siebert, who I started to study with back in the beginning, let's see, of 1994, after I graduated high school from South Haven and went to Western. So 94 was the first time I took a class with Dr. Siebert. And here we are over 20-some years later, and I'm still working on critical theory of religion, helping develop it as it pertains to Islam, the Muslim world, how it pertains to the New Radical Right, which is a book I'm working on right now. But today it's not about me. It's about Dr. Siebert. So we want to talk about your biography today. And since it's rich with experiences, and all those experiences have helped inform the critical theory of religion, which we work on. So tell me a little bit about your early life, about when and where you were born and your parents and...
So I was born in 1927. That was 2 years before the Great Depression. My brother was born 2 years later, and his life was always more difficult. And so I was born on the west side of Frankfurt, which was the working class people. And the Frankfurt school people like Fromm and Adorno were all born on the east side, the rich side of Frankfurt. So I was had this working class life. My father and my mother were working in a Jewish factory, for shoe factory. And so I had these first political experience as a little guy when the fascists on one side and the communists on the other side met underneath my window and were beating each other up. And then came the police and on horses and beat both of them up, and then came the hospital people and picked up the bodies. That happened every Saturday morning, and it was tremendously exciting for me. I waited for it all week long. So, and then, of course, came 1933, when I was 6 years old. Then first Hitler came into power, and then law and order was established, and the street in which I grew up was not only a working class street, but it was also a street for widows and orphans. All the fathers had died in the war. So the whole street then turned fascist. And the university, which was close by, turned fascist. So that was this tremendous, horrifying event where a large part of the nation were fascinated by Hitler and his program and his authoritarianism. And things went very well then. 1934, Hitler was able to give 6 million people jobs, which was 10% of the population. So there was great jubilation, and he was seen as a messiah. My parents voted still center party, the Catholic Party. The Catholic Party gave Hitler the emergency laws, which made him legitimately into a dictator. And then Hitler dissolved all these parties, and the whole parliament became fascist. And then, of course, the war came, the attacks on Poland, and the whole plan to not to conquer England, but to conquer Russia and to kill communists. The communists had already been put into concentration camps, and now Hitler marched with 4 million men into Russia and killed over 26 million Russians on the way, until he was stopped in Stalingrad and Kursk and in Berlin. So that was the early time as far as the whole politics was concerned. I grew up as a Catholic, Roman Catholic. My mother had been a Lutheran, And she converted to Catholicism. It took her 5 years to do so. So I grew up as a Catholic then. I was in the Catholic Youth Movement. There was a concordat between Hitler and the Vatican, according to which this youth movement could exist. But after 2 years, Hitler broke the concordat, and my leaders were beaten and tortured. We could not even open the coffins, so badly they looked in the when we had the funeral ceremonies. So there I saw a religion struggling with the modern society, with one version of it, not with liberalism, not with socialism, but with fascism. And that was deeply impressive. And out of this grew the motivation to have a critical theory of religion, which would be concerned with this antagonism between the sacred and the profane. In the Middle Ages, there was some harmony between the two, but modernity means that the two sides are struggling with each other. And we had a theory then which looked forward to a possible reconciliation of the two sides, which daily produces these culture problems, culture battles and struggles, like divorce or abortion or birth control or whatever. There are innumerable of these problems which come up every day and are very disturbing for the public sphere of our society.
One of the stories that you often tell to your students is the story of you on your way to the Lessing Gymnasium where you went to school. And on your way there, you bumped into an old lady.
Right.
Could you tell that story?
Right. So in the Catholic Youth Movement where I grew up, there was no anti-Semitism whatsoever. So people, priests in the parish, said that what happened to the Jews in Frankfurt, that this was a horrible thing. So, of course, unfortunately, the Christian churches had a lot of anti-Semitism. Luther was very anti-Semitic, and so were his Catholic partners, and so on. And so, but there was nothing of that in my Catholic education. So one morning, it was 1941, in spring, I went to this elite high school, humanistic high school, the Lessing Gymnasium, and my bike, this chain fell off and I had to push it, so I was a little bit late anyway. And there I saw an old little lady before me, maybe 70, 80 years old, and she carried two heavy suitcases. And so as I came behind her, I thought maybe I can put the suitcases on my bike and can help her a little bit. So when I came close to her, I saw that on the left side she had the yellow star, which showed that she was Jewish. Since the Nuremberg laws, she had to wear that star. So she did not dare to talk to me, and I was not supposed to talk to her. But I thought, well, you know, she needs help. So I talked to her, and slowly she also became more trusting, and in Frankfurt dialect, like every other woman in Frankfurt, she told me that the police had been in her house the day before and the night before and had told her to take all what she could carry and go into that Lessing Gymnasium, into the air shelter. And from there, she would be taken to Eastern Europe in a nice little village, and you wouldn't have to suffer the bustle of this big city, and they would be, which would be a very harmonious life there. So, so after she had told me that, I put her stuff on my bike, and we rode down to the Lessing Gymnasium, and they were already murmuring down in the basement. There were already hundreds of Jews in that basement waiting for transportation toward Eastern Europe. But the most tragic element in all of that is how much one does not know when one does something like this. I thought I did a good thing, you know, as a Catholic boy, to help the old lady and so on. But we met right before the IG Farben Industry Center in Frankfurt, which is still standing there today. And IG Farben produced the Cyclone B, by which the Jewish people and others, the gypsies and so on, were gassed in the camps. And so it was invented by the inventor of gas war, Fritz Haber, in 1915, a Jewish person too. And so, but we had no idea what was prepared in that building where we met. So she thought she would go to paradise in the eastern camps there, not the real paradise. So, but she had no idea of what would happen. And the Germans in general, my mother, working class woman, she thought camps were there to teach people work, and work would make them free. So gypsies didn't work, and Jews didn't work, and so all these, the communists did not work, and they were all lazy people, and they had to be taught to work. And so these camps were cheap labor resources. They even got a little salary, 50 cents or whatever. They had canteens where they could even buy something in the camp. So it was a cheap labor resource, and there were forced labor outside of the camp, and then there was forced labor inside of the camp. And it served the big corporations like IG Farben or ThyssenKrupp. And so it was a business affair as well. And they were not to get death camps from the beginning. They became death camps at the time of Pearl Harbor, when the World War, when the European War became a world war. And Hitler had announced three times in Parliament that if the Jewish high finance, that means bankers and so on, if they would once more instigate a war among the European nations, a world war and so on, then beyond Europe even, then that would not be the end of Europe, but it would be the end of the Jewish race. And so while we have no signature of Hitler under the death camp affairs and so on, it was all Heidegger, it was all his underlings, but nevertheless, it started at that time that the death camps far in the east, so far in the Russian territory, far east in Poland, that these camps then became death camps. Very contradictory, but these people who were killed now could not be workers anymore. But things became very irrational. Trains, which would have been used for the army, were used in order to transport. It was all very much illogical, non-logical, irrational, even in terms of Nazi thinking.
Right. And you remember Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass.
Right. So Kristallnacht, I was in a swimming pool in Frankfurt, very close to a very famous synagogue where Martin Buber were and the great Jewish mystics. And so I came out of the swimming pool, and one has to look at one's consciousness, so what one knows and what one doesn't know. So I came out, and there was beside the swimming pool, there was this big synagogue was burning. And the strange thing was that the engines, the fire engines were there, but they didn't extinguish the fire. They put water on the buildings on the right and the left in order to protect them, but they let the synagogue burn. So that was very strange, but I would be projecting things if I would say that I know exactly what was happening. But I was going to the main road in Frankfurt, the Zeil, and all the Jewish stores, there were many of them, things flew out the windows there. Mm-hmm. And that's where the name comes from, porcelain and lamps. And so that's why it's called the Kristallnacht. And at that time, then 30,000 Jews were put not into concentration camps, as I thought for some time, but they were put into normal prisons because a young Jew had killed a German diplomat in Paris. And Goebbels took that as a basis for his anti-Jewish campaign.
Mm-hmm. A few years ago, when we traveled to Frankfurt, I had the opportunity to go to the Lessing Gymnasium, mm-hmm. Your elite high school that you went to, and there was a picture on the wall of the students from this time, mm-hmm. this time period. And every so often there was a student that was missing from the picture. And I remember asking a friend of ours what that meant, and she said that those were Jewish students that were missing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, do you remember that? Do you remember the Jewish students missing?
There was maybe one or two Jewish students in there. So I was a little proletarian, so there were not many working class students there. So in each class there was one working class student, and we had a very hard time to get into the spirit of the middle classes. They were all traveling to the Nile River, and I didn't even know where the Nile River was. And my parents talked about sausages and nice things to eat, but they didn't talk about the world. And so the same thing was true for the Jewish people. Token people were taken in. So there was maybe one, two boys or girls in each class, and they disappeared slowly without anybody saying anything. Mm-hmm. We did not even know if they had gone to another town or if they had been ill or nothing. It was just absolute silence, but they disappeared.
Yeah. And you got in trouble one time with a Hitler Youth commander. If I remember the story right, you told your younger brother, Carl, not to go visit them and to study Greek and Latin instead.
But first, I would like to say something else about these classes and the mm-hmm. Jewish people. The class, they had a humanistic level, and many of them, the students, were anti-Nazi from their background, from their parents. So, but as we met later on, later years, our class comrades and so on, they were always amazed that I was so stubbornly anti and so suspicious always of what was happening, because one of them had a father who was the conductor of the Frankfurt Orchestra, and he was supposed to fire Jewish violinists or pianists and so on, and he refused to do so. So the parents were really actively resisting, but the children, they did not understand why their parents were in trouble. So I think that my Catholic education and the humanistic education made me critical toward the Hitler Youth. And so nevertheless, I had to join the Hitler Youth. It was a state youth, and every citizen had to be part of it. But so I didn't go most of the time. And so I wanted my brother, I told my brother, Carl, I said, you don't go to the Hitler Youth on Wednesday afternoon at 3 o'clock and marching around there to learn Latin and learn Greek and learn Hebrew. And then later on, you will be something. Well, he got angry. My father had died early from cancer, so I had to take care of him, but he didn't want to be taken care of. And so he went to the Hitler Youth leader and said, My brother didn't allow me to come. That's why I'm late. My brother said you will not last very long, and he should do his Latin and so on. And so, the Gauleiter, the head of the state of Hessen, then took the money away from me, the school money, and it was all of the salary of my mother. So I had to leave the school because of that. But my mother. There were, in Nazism, they did a lot for workers, so power through joy trips on the Rhine River on boats. So there was a boat trip, and all the shoe factory was on the boat. And so my mother went to the director of the corporation, who had taken over from the Jews, Schneider was the name, who had gone to London, and so the Nazis took over the factory. So my mother went to him and said, think what has happened, the governor took the money away, and now I cannot pay for it, my salary is too low, and so on and so on. And so he just stopped her and said, we'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. So you see that fascism is not so totalitarian as people think. There are struggles under the surface between the economic groups, between the military groups, between the SS and the army and so on. But it is the charismatic leader who keeps it down and creates the element of unity. So for a few years then, that factory paid my school money until I was drafted, and then they gave it back to me, the school money, after I did heroic things. So the state paid it again, but there was no school anymore.
Right. So you're about the age of 15. This is when the Air Force officer showed up to your house and basically informed you that you had been enlisted into the Luftwaffe, into the German Air Force. Mm-hmm. And I know you had said that the Catholic Youth Movement was already greatly influential on you, especially Pastor Rudolphi, mm-hmm. right? Which you've written a book about, Pastor Rudolphi. Yeah. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, so he was the pastor of this Sancta Familia parish at the outskirts of Frankfurt. Now, Frankfurt had become Protestant already in 1525 or so, it was a totally Protestant country, but a city. But then Catholics suddenly came back again and restored parishes who had not been active for 400 or 500 years. So nevertheless, he was very energetic, very dynamic. And he had been in the First World War and had been wounded there and was formed by this war experience, like Hitler was, like my father was, and so on. And so I was very fascinated by him. And during the war, he became very prophetic. That means he applied Isaiah and Jeremiah and Jesus and so on to the scene, to the historical situation. So another book was written about him, and they painted him as a Nazi. I painted him as an anti-Nazi and so on. And so the other one, he had put up the Nazi flag in 1933, as everybody had to do. And so from that, he started and said he was a Nazi. But I had so much evidence that he, whenever he gave a sermon, the Gestapo was in his church, usually ex-priests who had become Gestapo officials, and they would write everything down, and the Gestapo brought him down. He was beaten up in the Gestapo basement and so on. So he suffered day after day. The youth movement, the Hitler Youth, came into the church, took us, the altar boys, out and so on. There was a lot of problems there through 12 years. And then the interesting thing is leader of the Nazi party in Frankfurt, in Ginheim, this suburb, mm-hmm. Who had done all these disturbances and so on, came to Rudolfi, and they had an hour-long talk with each other and somehow reconciled. Rudolfi, we don't know exactly what happened, but somehow reconciled or forgiven for all of this. But then came another event. On the day at the end, toward the end of the war, an American Liberator bomber for engine came over the church very low, but because it had been damaged, but the pilot and the men could still jump out, and so one of them jumped into a little forest close by, and he was wounded. And he was laying there on the ground and asked for doctor, and so on. And this fellow there, this Nazi leader, the Bauchspieß was his name, he went down there and took his revolver and shot him and said, here's your doctor, and so on. But Rudolfi was there to give him the last sacraments. Didn't matter if he was Protestant or Catholic or whatever, he was a Christian, and so he went there with his bike and went to the man. He could not rescue him anymore, but he gave him the last sacraments. And so then when the American army came into Frankfurt, they right away looked for the criminal who had shot this pilot. And so they needed now witnesses, and they were communists who had survived, but the Americans did not trust the communists. But there was these Christians, and Rudolfi was one of them, and they asked him to come in and to give witness against him. And so Rudolfi said that it was under the seal of confession. And the judge said, but he's a Protestant, so his seal doesn't matter. But he said, no, it doesn't matter, Protestant or Catholic, everybody is baptized, it is under the seal of confession, and he could not witness against him. So they went to the communist anyway, who gave witness, and then he was sentenced to death and was hanged. And one of the chaplains of Rudolfi did the burial. He is buried in Frankfurt in the cemetery there. So these are some of these tragic things where Rudolfi would say, nobody will understand later on what happened here. You know, it is so unbelievably confusing that a high-level cultural nation with Mozart and Beethoven and Goethe and Schiller and so on could suddenly turn into such barbarism. Nobody had expected this, you know, but Frankfurt School did predict it, and they predicted also what we have now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So back to at 15, the Air Force officer comes to your door. You're already deeply skeptical of fascism, mm-hmm. of the Nazis, mm-hmm. of Hitler. But you were being told that you were going to be in the Air Force, mm-hmm. and you're going to defend Frankfurt from the bombers. Mm-hmm. And as you always say that, you know, at first, you know, the idea of doing this was not something that was very pleasing to you, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, on principle, you were against this party and mm-hmm. the war goals. But at the same time, the defense of women and children mm-hmm. huddling in the basements of their houses as bombs, you know, the mm-hmm. saturation bombings mm-hmm. happening is something that you felt you had to defend. You had to defend those women and children. Yeah. So what was it like going into the German Air Force? What were your experiences with that?
Well, I mean, we also had to listen to British broadcasting secretly. It was death penalty. And there was a Nazi in every house who watched everybody. And we had one in the house, and he listened. And he said, Rudy, you cannot do this. I have to tell. And he never told. So, but... So that we knew a little bit more than people knew around, so about what was coming in terms of bombers and so on. So, yeah, so I was in the shut down probably 18 bombers. And so the question was how I would justify that cooperation. And so what happened on the day when I was brought to the Sossenheim airport where I was trained, the city of Frankfurt was bombed, and so I saw people in the tar, you know, burning the whole city with old wooden houses. And I then, in my own conscience, I said, okay, this I can, I'm not for these guys, but I'm for those people there who are killed. And if I can distract, you know, there came 500 bombers, 1,000 bombers in an attack. If I can distract some of them and they throw their bombs into the Taunus Mountains, instead of into the west side of Frankfurt or so, then this would be a good thing. So with this, I did this with a good conscience, and I discussed that also with Senator McGovern, who had done the bombing. And we both were aware, you know, that on Judgment Day, we will have to stand up for whatever we are doing. He thought he did the right thing. He thought that that bombing would help to remove the Nazis, you know. And I was more concerned with the people who had to suffer under all of this. And I also had doubt if the bombing, the saturation bombing, really was helpful, because in a certain way it brought people together. It made it even made them into more believers into the Hitler cause than they were before. So that is, you know, that is why I had doubts about the whole mission. And While the attack on the Normandy, Eisenhower commanded 60,000 men, but in the struggle of Moscow, 10 million men were involved. So the Nazi regime was killed off in the huge areas of Russia. The Paulus army was 1 million, one army alone, 1 million. And maybe a few thousand came back in the end of the 15
years. And General Paulus was,
General Paulus
was
converted.
In the east.
He converted, yeah. He surrendered in a store somewhere in Stalingrad, and Hitler thought he had made him into a marshal just a few months before. He thought he should have killed himself instead of going to Moscow and being put into cages and marched to Moscow. They were not put into cages, but they had to march through Moscow, and it was a very shameful thing. But he converted and became a socialist, and he died in East Germany in the 50s. So he was that what the Germans then call a traitor, like the assassins of Hitler.
Yeah.
So that you know, that was a very complicated situation, and as I said, we with McGovern we remained close friends, and because it's so hard to decide those questions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We both agreed that fascism is an evil thing, and we've both fought against it. But on the other hand, I tried to protect those women and children, because there were no men anymore. The men were all at the Eastern Front,
right?
You know, or the Western Front. And so all what was there were old men and women and children. And,
right. This is the beginning of the Volkssturm, towards the end of the war.
Right. Yeah, so these were old men and young men, and so on, yeah. And I saw them hanging, you know, from the trees if they did not function well and did not obey.
Mm-hmm.
So these were very, very complicated times. And so McGovern and I, we thought that on Judgment Day we would have to get our final judgment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and then after you got out of the Air Force because of the, as you say, that there's no more planes left, or very few planes flying, you were put into the Wehrmacht, so into the German Wehrmacht and the German Army. Where did you go with that? Where did you fight?
So we found a work about the Battle of Aschaffenburg and by an American colonel, and he did a very good job. He took the German resources and American resources and Canadian ones and reconstructed the whole battle. And I learned from that a lot, because when you are in the battle itself, I was a lieutenant, it's a very small area which you look over. And so I had no idea, for instance, that the Battle of the Hahnenkamp, which was reported everywhere against Patton, that that this battle was part of, that this mountain was part of a whole mountain range. So you have this little tunnel vision. I did not know that the bunker system, which I saw there, was part of a second western, like the Siegfried Line. So Patton had broken through the first one, but there was a second one. But I was not the only one, but American soldiers too, because when they crossed the Rhine, they were told, you know, everything is okay now. You will not find any resistance. And then suddenly they came to Aschaffenburg and to Alzenau and found fierce resistance. And that was the book about it. How can suddenly, when a whole army is already beaten, you find such horrible resistance? And they were very upset, the soldiers, and the morale went to a deep level, because they had expected all would be easy now. And then suddenly it became very, very tense and a lot of casualties and so on. Yeah. About the planes, you know, I said there were no planes, but the officer who wrote the book said there were planes, but I could never call any planes in, you know, against American tanks. So there was an attack where I faced 80 American tanks, and one usually would call the Air Force in, but there was no Air Force. But there was these new planes were there. They were rocket planes, which could only stay in the air 20 minutes, but they flew over the American lines and the machine guns, the tanks and so on. But I never had any access to them. So, but they were around. So, so very late, I mean, 50, 60, 70 years later, you suddenly discover things of which you had no idea when you had to make all these decisions, you know. You have to make all these small decisions in a situation which you are not knowing very well.
Right, right. If I remember correctly, there was an episode where an officer assumed you had deserted because you were off doing something.
Right. So there was the Battle of the Hahnenkamp, and I gave the orders to my group, the 250 the men, to withdraw, and it was already late in the afternoon, Sunday after Easter Sunday, 1945. And to go as fast as possible, you know, to crawl or jump or whatever to these to the forests where the tanks could not follow. And then the American army stopped fighting at 5 o'clock. So they fought from 8 to 5. And they, at 5 o'clock, they put all the guns on automatic. And so then they would not follow. But they were so demoralized that they just marched slowly as, well, like a Sunday afternoon trip with the family, you know, walked slowly up to the forest and were all taken out by machine guns from the tanks. And and the tanks could break in because the Hungarians, who were fascists too, all of Europe was fascist. So we had a few hundred officers, Hungarian officers, and they deserted in the morning at 4 o'clock, and we didn't notice it. And so the tanks could break in. So that was the last battle. And at the end of this battle, then, I had two of my soldiers who were still alive but wounded, and they wanted to have a priest. And so since I thought, you know, 5 o'clock, nobody fights anymore. So I went to the next village, the next valley, and I left my weapons back except a revolver. And so then I met an old pastor, and I poured him up and two, and he gave the two the last sacrament. And then they died during the night. But I wanted to bring the old man back because it got dark and he had big glasses and couldn't see anything. So I went back with him again without weapons except the one thing. And so there I suddenly faced the SS with a motorcycle and a hangar. And they went back and forth behind the lines and caught everybody and called him a traitor. And they were hanging already in the moonshine there, the three old men and young men and so on. So at the last moment, as they were already signing the papers, my general from Bavaria, high school teacher from Bavaria, he came, you know, and saw the whole situation. It was very dangerous because SS didn't obey, you know, army generals. So, but he had humor in this horrible situation. He pulled the helmet down over my face. I was very thin at that time. And I disappeared in my helmet. And he said, look at this. I mean, it's not worth a bullet, you know. And then we don't have many bullets anymore. And then we don't have many men anymore neither. And so, and by making his Bavarian jokes there, he was able to get me out of there. And so I was very lucky.
So you weren't hung?
Yeah, no, I wasn't hanged. Hung. No.
Right. That's fortunate, right? That right. He was...
Providence.
He was there. Providence, exactly, yeah. Exactly. You were captured soon after that in the war, and you were captured with an Austrian officer.
Yeah.
And this antagonism between Germans and Austrians, you know, in America, we don't really know the difference. They sound exactly the same, you know, on and on. But there's that antagonism there. And somehow that antagonism came up when you guys were captured. So,
well, after all the troops, all my men were gone after that battle, then in the forest near Alzenau, which I had taken before. And that is also something which I remember as something positive. So, somehow the area had been conquered already, and the white flags were hanging from the church towers. So, but in the evening, the Germans made a counterattack, and so the flags were taken down again. There was a signal, you know, the war has started. The German population was very upset about the whole thing. They thought peace was there, and so when I went somewhere, they gave me scrambled eggs there, but they said, go as fast as possible. And I slept in another farmer's bed for 3 hours, and then he begged me to go. So they loved us because we were their sons, but they hated us because we brought the war back again. So nevertheless, I moved at evening into Alzenau, and the Patton had to run so fast that he left his hospital in the basement of the mayor's office there. And so in there, there were Germans and they were Americans, and they were treated equally, according to the Geneva Convention. The convention holds, you know. One can be more hopeful than people sometimes are. So, and he had treated the Germans like he had treated the Americans, and so we did. Now, the Americans were the prisoners, the others were free, but they were still wounded and got the same medicine and the same doctors and so on. So that, you know, there's something very important to see in that desperate situation, that there are really signs of hope, that gas was never used in spite of the fact that everybody had it. There was an agreement on gas and it was not used. So one can make treaties and treaties hold. And if it was only because of retaliation, you know, that may be, it may not be too noble moral motivation, but you're afraid the other will do the same. So Churchill was tempted when Werner von Braun, the SS colonel who got us to the moon, when he sent all these rockets to London, then Churchill wanted to put gas into the bombs. He wanted to gas the German territory. And the Admiralty told him, you know, the Germans will put the gas into the rockets and then you will be poisoned. And so he did not, it was never done. So after Dresden, Hitler wanted to shoot all American pilots in the things. He said they have broken all rules of the Geneva Convention. But Dresden was bombed 4 times by hundreds of bombers, British and then Americans in the morning. And so it was so devastating that he thought, you know, all rules had been broken. And he gave orders to shoot all the American pilots and British pilots in his prison. There were thousands of them in there. And the German generals were able to persuade him that the Americans and British would do the, and the Canadians would do the same thing. Mm-hmm. So that was the, so the positive thing is that some rules do hold, as animalistic as these wars are and as cruel and brutal and fanatic and so on. I think the German people, soldiers, never hated Americans or Canadians or British. They may have hated French out of some strange reason, and they hated Russians, you know. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, and thousands of German soldiers moved from the east to the west in order to be taken prisoner by Americans.
They would rather be taken prisoner by Americans, and Canadians.
And very upset about mm-hmm. that, you know. Yes.
I think it's one of the reasons why a lot of the Nazi brass mm-hmm. were in the hands of the Americans and the British as opposed to the Soviets. So when they were put on trial in the Nuremberg, it was, of course, the Soviets once wanted to show that they were guilty and they could execute them. And the Americans, the British, the French said, no, we have to have a fair trial. And so knowing that, the Nazi brass would rather have gone to the Allied forces in the West. So when were you captured?
Well, that was after Easter, so Easter Monday or so, in Alzenau, so in the forest there, after this battle. And so the last thing, maybe we should mention that very shortly, very tragic type of a thing, which shows the senselessness, why so many soldiers come home and are nihilists, really. After that battle there, the American troops followed us, the tanks followed us, and so we put trees down so that it slowed them down. But while they were slowed down, we were in a little restaurant, and we celebrated the birthday of the innkeeper's daughter. She was 18 years old. And so we had champagne, you know, in the middle of the war, and the tanks are coming, you know, and the general said, you know, Prosit to, you know, and happy birthday, and we sang happy birthday and so on. And then, you know, the first bullets came through the window. And so he said, well, now we want to show the Americans the last time German strategy. It was really German tactics, but he wanted to show German strategy. And so he took about 400 men, led them behind the mountain to the same street, maybe 2 miles up the road, and put them there on a hill. And so the tanks came, they came to the restaurant, there was a bunker, they put flamethrowers on the bunker and fried the people in there like chickens, which happens in war. So this was not even a war crime. And then they marched up there, you know, with the tanks and the infantry on the right and the left, and had their guns on their shoulder and cigarette in the mouth. And at 5 o'clock, the next village, you know, where they could rest and see some Fräuleins and have some coffee and whatever. And then there was turmoil in the next village because the enemy was coming, and they were particularly afraid of the black soldiers, who were the best, who gave them all the chocolate. So there is this war psychology which makes strange realities for people. Nevertheless, he put these people on that hill. And so then suddenly gave order to shoot. And it was maybe 1-2 minutes only. And they were only guns and machine guns and no heavy weapons or whatever. And then he stopped and told them all to withdraw. And what he wanted to show was that he knew what the barrels, the degree to which the barrels of the tanks could go up. And it couldn't go up high enough. So they shot into that hill now all the time and didn't hit anybody.
The American tanks didn't
American
hit anybody.
American tanks did, yeah. So then 8 years later, I went with my American wife, dear Margie, I went to that restaurant, 8 years only later. And of course, he couldn't recognize me anymore in uniforms and so on. People looked different. And so I said, do you remember your daughter's birthday, the 18th birthday? Yeah, of course, I remember. And the soldiers, he said they were here all night long and shot all my cows. They thought they were tanks. And so, and then they said, well, we also sang happy birthday. Yes, he said. And then I said, what happened then? Well, he said, well, then the Americans came, and then they marched on with the tanks, and then there was a horrible shooting, you know, and then everything was quiet. And then I said, what happened then? Well, then came those bags, you know, in tents where they poured the fallen people down, and they put them all up in his yard, and there were 92 of them. Oh. So there were 92 young people from Texas or Oklahoma or who did not really know where they were or why they were where they were, and who thought the war was over, and they were only on a mopping up program there, so nothing serious. The real troops were already in Würzburg and Bamberg and on the way to Berlin, where they never arrived, but they went south then. So the war was really over, and there this unbelievable casualties, these casualties and so on. So nothing has ever been for me so as a symbol of the insanity of war, and therefore in the critical theory of religion has this anti-war component in itself.
Right.
Well, that seems like a pretty good place to take a break here, guys. About 45 minutes, and I think this is some wonderful, wonderful material. So what I do want to tell everybody for the podcast that we're doing, go ahead and look for part two. This is part one. There's going to be more parts coming with Rudolph J. Siebert and Dustin John Bird. Dustin J. Bird, I guess. I'm not used to calling him that, being that he's my brother and all. So, well, we'll be back, and I look for part two coming up on the podcast with Rudy J. Siebert. Awesome man. He's got so much good stuff to tell.
This has been a production of the Moondog Radio Network, a division of Moondog Productions. Copyright 2019.